Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. This is our final seminar, as you know. So any thoughts or reflections about what you've taken in, how you think differently about change, transitions, or any remaining questions you have on our first three topics from anyone? We're going to talk about some specific challenges and opportunities in transitions, and especially this is designed to think about your coaching business for those of you who are coaches and looking at niche development and how you can incorporate the mind and brain science of change and transition with what you do. So I want to emphasize, I know I received some emails about people who would not be able to attend live time tonight. Those of you who have any questions or anything you'd like to say or add or ask, I welcome any emails, any feedback, and if there's any way I can be of help to you, please let me know. But what, first of all, before we start the seminar, are there any aspects you'd like to discuss or questions that you have? Okay, well, I will move us then to our lecture mode and save some time at the end if you have anything that you'd like to add or ask or discuss then. Okay, let's talk a bit about some specific challenges as well as opportunities in the transitions that you'll be dealing with yourself as well as with your clients. First, let's talk about some niche applications of this whole topic of change and transition. Let me give you some examples. Practicing professionals, healthcare, financial, legal, have in common that they've dedicated their careers to a body of knowledge. Their clients come to them for the purpose of purchasing their expertise, and their expertise to solve special problems and give specific advice is backed by professional standards substantiated by laws or codes. But consider that even with their rigorous training to solve specialized problems, and I've named just a few, and provide specialized advice, these professionals have probably not been trained to know themselves better, to understand the dynamics of human behavior, to remove stress as an obstacle to their success, to pursue personal development as vigorously as they pursue professional advancement, maybe even to convert from a work ethic to a performance ethic, and to emotionally and strategically manage career transitions. They'd assume they do one thing, the profession they've trained for, all their lives. Another genre, performance professionals, such as actors, professional athletes. The primary challenge these clients have is self-regulation, to stay grounded in their ideals and especially in their energy management in the face of extraordinary demands and stimulating success, and especially, for example, retirement transitions for pro athletes. These are all exactly the things that we specialize in. As professional coaches, as mentor coaches, our expertise is in change and facilitating that change and transition. Here's a lesson we can learn about the importance of self-regulation for all loss, change, and transition. Champion sports figures are alert to the importance of aftermaths, the points of the play immediately following a really important or a tense or a hotly contested moment of play. Both the winner and the loser of any of these intense encounters of extraordinary achievement, especially, tend to be a compromised aftermath. The winner is excited by the victory, and this carries over to affect the next play and compromise it. The loser is frustrated, which carries over into errors or trying too hard in the next play. These aftermath points and plays are likely to be lost on errors. The wise player approaches the aftermath with self-regulation, conservatively, and with full conservation and concentration. Here's an example. The announcer at a Texans game on defensive lineman Casey. His quote, "That's so often the case with young players, especially a rookie. One good play, then one bad one. After doing a spectacular tackle on the next play, Casey was offsides." This is an instance of self-regulation and being on tilt, the excitement from making a really good play. I believe the most challenging areas of what we will help people do is to deal with extraordinary success. People have got feeling bad down. The greatest challenge when you're accustomed to feeling bad is to stay with feeling good, because that's a departure. That's a departure from the familiar or the comfort zone. Success does not create an immunity to failure. A loss does not foreshadow lack of confidence or disbelief. The next play is the next play. The next point is the next point. You've lost something very important, yet tomorrow is still the next day. Your next career is the same thing. This is the aftermath of everything that you've done before, everything you've worked hard for. It will stand alone on its own. And think of you, those who have made transitions into professional coaching, every one of you are at least on a second career. Additional people who have significant challenge in dealing with the emotions of a transition are the ones whose process begins with a significant and often abrupt loss, job, significant relationship, disability, divorce. With these changes and subsequent transitions, the need for help in managing emotions and regulating states of mind is important in itself. Then, this task becomes important as it affects other components of a situation. For example, the significant emotion of a divorce in the subsequent divorce proceedings and asset management creates challenges such as making the business part of the divorce only about the business of divorce, not letting emotional factors derail logic and judgment. And this is true if it's a small amount of money, a small amount of property, or none, or especially with larger amounts. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place and one position get most entrenched. For example, a place I see this in coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he founded 32 years ago to his two children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles and relationships. I did a series of retreats with a good buddy called What's Next Exec for current senior executives and CEOs within a year or so of retirement, designed to help them create an informed and really masterful transition to their next contribution or career, because most of these people know they're not going to be happy playing golf past at least a couple of months. So many of the executives we see at this retreat have been in corporate America for three decades or more and want to retire to pursue their own business or consulting or another career. They've not had the experience of setting and collecting professional fees, of operating by creating their own structure, even of doing a website. They've been surrounded and supported by a corporate structure, so their challenge is analogous to those of you who have moved from a paid or structured position to opening your own professional practices. You know a lot of what they're going through. They've never had to market their services or set up a PayPal account or establish a business name or find somebody to do a website. So retired is not an identity. It's the lack of one. So consider this in thinking about what you're doing. Consider for just a moment, what do your clients want from you? Pick a client and think about it for a minute. Think in one succinct sentence, 10 words or less, how would you express what your client wants from you? Jot it down if you've thought of it. The coach and client become co-authors of a new story and create a current meaning that can allow a distinctness of the old versus the new, an evolving new story. We're always teaching others how to respond to us. A client is always teaching the coach what it's like to be her, creating an in vivo demonstration of what needs to be known so that the coach can teach it back to her out loud. And remember, 90 to 95% of the operating system is unconscious. So many of the algorithms of emotion, of patterns, of relationships, of behavior are not readily accessible, yet we see the outcome. So we have to be open to that learning to see the process evolve and not let teaching the client our theories or let our agenda get in the way. Although we inevitably listen within the context of our own system of meaning and knowing, we need to continuously bridge to the experience and system of meaning of the client. In this co-created space, the client can develop an authentic story. So what I believe our clients want from us as mentor coaches is the adult version of what we as children wanted from our parents and what our children wanted from us. Consider this. Our clients want unselfconscious participation in serious work and sometimes in play. Acceptance of praise without embarrassment or deflection so that we give it back to its creator, the client, as self-statement. Full immersion in, yet not full reaction to, their full feelings, never losing sight of their internal perspective and best interest. It always is the client's story that we're helping develop. To hope that we will see the self, the client, hopes to become, and see the evolving new story that sometimes gets obscured from the client's view. To see at times a thought, a feeling, or behavior as an answer to a question its creator has not consciously dared to ask. To hope that we hear the silent intent embedded in the compromised result. To see the hope camouflaged in the frustrating process. To validate the client's intuition. To hope that the coach will not be awkward, self-conscious, or say anything that would distract from the client's immersion in this process. The architecture of trust silently forms while you're talking about other things. Collaborating together, even laughing together, gives oxygen to hope, highlights the relief and release of new experience, and pushes creativity to full flight. We help the client mourn the old story. We know that no matter how ready to change they are, it's like saying goodbye to an old friend who's been there for a long time. The client mourns the self that he or she leaves behind, the self of the old story. Invention can be sabotaged and creativity imprisoned by remaining in that old story, repeating the same storylines. Julia Cameron said it beautifully in her book, The Artist's Way. I am astounded that I could let go of the drama of being a starving artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea. We, the client and us, we are in the present moment together and co-create a new story with our clients. We believe in someone until they can believe in themselves, and they'll teach us both why. The corollary to believing in the client is that the coach must be the kind of person in whom the client can believe and respect and trust. The client has to believe the coach will respond, guide, teach, and model in a way that facilitates growth. This bond, this immersion and understanding within the present moment may be one of the most powerful and most change-making experiences that the client has ever had. I believe probably the most, because I believe any client who really sticks with the process will have an impact for the rest of his or her life, personally, professionally, or both. I also remain curious about how my clients continue to write their narratives after we end formal coaching. I believe that coaching is a developmental process that continues in its influence throughout life. They've downloaded a model, an evolving, transforming model of themselves and a model of collaboration that they can refer to. I've said to clients, I'm going to be your coach for life, though regular meetings will be necessary only for a short period of time. Maybe consider intervals of quarterly updates or maybe once a year that can be beneficial for the client. Booster shots, witnessing a continued developmental journey at regular intervals and not having to have a problem or an issue in order to meet. What we do with each client is not about being right, not about having pristine in theory or technique, not even mutually idealizing achievement. But the bottom line is always this: does it work? Does what you're doing work? If it doesn't work, do something else. If it works, do more of it. Coaching allows the beauty of waking up to specific possibilities, strengths, untapped resources. We help people become more of who they really are. The client must risk bringing an issue to the table and further that risk by looking at it openly. The exchange must be worthy and true. It must be real. The coach must be fully present, fully himself or herself. Hemingway captured this principle, I believe, when he wrote about the craft of writing. Write the truest sentence you know. As we nudge a client to consider their relationship with themselves, their own self-reflection and self-empathy developed collaboratively, we wonder, sometimes out loud, to look together at their important storylines, to ask, how exactly are you taking care of yourself? I will, as part of an assessment at the beginning and part of the first coaching session, will usually ask clients how often they work out so that there's a whole mind, body, spirit approach to their change and their transformation. And if it's not that often, I may gently nudge them. We'll discuss a wellness story in just a moment. How are you honoring your needs and your ideals, your relationships? Have you created something that now seems like it's controlling you? Are you framing yourself by your gender, your role, your purpose? Do you daily find things to be grateful for, to celebrate? An ideal coaching co-creation is to reflect or validate the client, to tell the client what they already know and just a little bit more. That little bit more may be a challenge, a conceptualization, a nudge toward initiative or action, or a reminder to pause momentarily to consider, to contemplate, or even to celebrate. So, and this is in your outline, I want to discuss an overview then of how we facilitate change in coaching. There are 12 caveats. I've distilled these principles that focus on facilitating change in the coaching relationship. One, each person's life story is created. Recognition and acceptance of story ownership is a prerequisite to assessment and change. Two, understanding begins with examinations of which storylines work and which do not. Then, to change the ones that don't work. Ones that do work need to be kept, possibly enhanced. Three, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing isn't. I'm sorry, let me say that differently, because this is important. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. And it may not be that third bite of cheesecake. Four, distinguish what to change, what to accept, what to let go, and what to enhance. Those four categories of things. That might take an appointment with yourself to brainstorm, or be a question for a client. Placing energy into what works, coupled with accepting and letting go of what can't be changed, immediately results in significant effectiveness. Five, when people create their own answers, they have signed on to invest in the outcome. Questions direct, clarify, illuminate, even story bust. Six, someone has to change an internal model of assumptions at times to sustain a new story. Remember that beliefs drive behavior, behavior drives performance. Beliefs sometimes are the bedrock of what has to be changed. Seven, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. So we need to learn to recognize our own assumptions and beliefs and how they color what we perceive or determine what we perceive. Assumptions manifest as feelings and behaviors. By making assumptions explicit, those which facilitate and those which interfere both become visible. Eight, change is constant and inevitable. It's the resistance to change that generates most problems. People are most successful when they learn from yesterday, anticipate tomorrow, but integrate the impact of a new experience for choice architecture in this moment. If someone's protesting change, they've already engaged it. Nine, small changes lead to big changes. Issues that may seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue. Specify a step to take for progress. For example, professionals get overwhelmed with the amount of tasks and responsibilities. Don't be afraid to get simple. Focus on and clarify one issue that can be dealt with effectively within the next day or the next hour. This focus on specific action exercises effectiveness and initiates a model of mastery. Remember, we talked about if you want to change a habit, focus on the system, not the goal. The stepwise system of what you do, because each step is a choice. And when you look at that choice, remember the Ben Fletcher study, University of Hertfordshire, about losing 11 pounds. Every bite was a choice. Focus on the system. 10. Solutions, causes, problems are not always related or even interconnected. The therapist, for example, attunes to problem, conflict, and development for progress to occur. The coach uses this space to focus on creating a new story to align needs and ideals, to strategize toward a goal, to look at possibilities instead of problems, which activates new neuronal connections and networks in the client's brain. The coach listens to join talents and strengths with possibilities and vision to strategically pursue goals. 11, a collaboration keeps both individuals together on the same side, looking at the scene together. And that's the essence of the nature of our relationship with our clients that is unique to all professionals, a collaborative relationship. We're not the expert. We're not the consultant telling somebody how to solve problems. We collaboratively engage an understanding and a creation, a co-created creation of a new story with a client as point of reference. Empathic resonance generates feeling understood. Then you can make more powerful coaching interventions. Also, validation of what's positive will have several times the effect of the focus on the negative. A comment perceived as judgmental can result in a defensive action. Remember from conversational intelligence, the first few words of what someone hears or reads boots up a particular mindset of what's processing then the entire remainder of the conversation. If those first few words are perceived as judgmental, critical, it boosts up a mindset that's mediated by cortisol and adrenaline. So trust and guardedness becomes a foreground and a framework. A collaborative conversation boosts up the mindset mediated by the whole neurochemical system of oxytocin, so that this chemical of bonding and connection processes the remainder of the conversation. You're in it together with the client. Together, you can go someplace new. And 12, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what's not will become evident and self-perpetuating. And again, don't be afraid to be simple. A physician client who's completed the 26th grade has forgotten how to talk simply. You see vestiges of that with me from time to time. Remember, how you work with your client provides a model that will be imitated of how they can work with their patients or their clients or their partners or their colleagues or proteges. You're establishing a model. So, now let's look at your wellness story. A significant aspect of change and transition is to build a new wellness story. Wellness is a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of a life story of wellness to the individual. When this ownership is alive, the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment becomes the framework, the mindset. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you get a new car every few years, the approach would be different than if you knew you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life. You'd probably do research to know the best care for the car, maybe change the oil more frequently, do everything possible for care and maintenance. Knowing it will be the only car for the rest of your life, probably take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you will have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. Wellness is a system of energy. Wellness is also an ongoing process of choices. It's never static. We never stay at the same place. So it consistently has to be assessed. Wellness is not something you begin to plan at age 65 or even at age 50. Rather, every choice you make each day writes your wellness story. Here's an illustration of those little choices. Overall wellness is not based on some big monumental choice, but on little things. Again, focus on the system, If you plan to run 30 minutes on the treadmill, but after 10 get off, convinced that you're a little stiff today, it's one small choice, no big deal. Nobody has a heart attack because of 20 minutes less on the treadmill every day, or one day, rather. You resolve to cut empty calories, but then grab a few peanut M&Ms from the candy bowl. Don't really think about the choice, because no single M&M, not even five, caused anyone to have diabetes. But consider this. Everything matters. It's a system. You take in 100 calories more each day than you burn, and in 1 year, you gain 9 pounds. That's less than the calories in a regular Coke or a regular beer. Our wellness success is the cumulative result of daily choices that we don't rationalize away or don't justify into oblivion. We are in a revolution in the science of wellness and aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time, right now, today. This has taken a while because health is biologically way more complex than disease. So let's look at this from another perspective. The story we engage with our body is one of two possibilities. This is an either-or. This is a closed system, a zero-sum game, decay or growth. Dr. Henry Lodge, Jr., who wrote the book Younger Next Year, it's a perennial bestseller, and a companion book, Younger Next Year for Women, is an internist in New York City who's devoted almost 40 years of his professional life to wellness research. I met him at a conference. We both shared a venue. We read each other and collaborated. If we assume, basically what he says, 70% of aging is not aging, but decay. These are his findings. If we assume that ailments and deterioration are a normal part of growing old, and that we diminish activity and deteriorate physically as well as in quality of life, the change on the cellular level will be decay. Inactivity and the absence of signals to grow result in body and brain decay. This is evidence-based and scientifically proven. Another story is that both decay and functional aging are largely optional. This alternate story is growth. We send signals to our body of daily exercise, emotional meaning, good nutrition, zest for living. And here's a quote from Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. The new wellness story includes a central storyline of exercise. No negotiations, no excuses, serious exercise. According to Dr. Lodge, after age 50, 6 days a week for the rest of your life is mandatory. Lodge emphasizes that 4 of those 6 days need to be serious aerobic exercise for the rest of your life. Biologically, your body only knows 2 things, growth or decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body and bathe cells in either repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels, and it's wounded blood vessels that kill you. Mortality falls with exercise. I had regularly worked out 2 or 3 days a week and done various kinds of athletic things, but then after collaboration with Lodge, I religiously did 6 days a week, and even for me, it's made a world of difference. It's something that, well, I'll talk about a mindset that he emphasizes. Of 3,000 people surveyed, 3 activities stood out above all others as ones that prompted procrastination: exercise, nutritional plan, retirement plan. For each of these, short-term desires or just maintaining the status quo currently can trump long-term goals. Now, consider this in terms of a mindset for what you need to do, including working out daily. When you have work duties or projects or assignments, you respond to them routinely and promptly. You get up and go to work every day. You don't debate about it, whether you will or won't, or bargain with yourself, well, I'll really get with it next Tuesday, but I'm going to knock off the rest of the week. Or feel virtuous if you do. It's a mindset. You don't have to waste energy doing this. This suggests that a task, such as exercise, be treated with the same mindset as work. With work, you don't have to get up every day and debate about whether you do it, whether you're going to take off a couple of days, skip it. Work is there. You get up, you go to work. In school, later in work, you show up. It's an organizing force, a deeply etched default mode. You go to work every day, whatever constitutes work, including full-time parenting. Exercise can be the same mindset. For some, it's like a new job. It's a full commitment, a serious commitment. It requires a plan, just like your business. According to Lodge, daily exercise, like work, should be right up there, trumped only by serious illness or family needs, the default story. So you structure your exercise. You don't find time to do it. You don't do it with whatever time is left over during the day. It's structured. For me, every day at 2 o'clock, I'm at the gym. Nothing trumps that. It's part of my daily routine. It feels like something's missing if I were ever to not do it. But I don't schedule clients. I don't schedule training. I don't return calls. Nothing happens. It's the time that is part of the structure, so I don't have to debate about it. Another very quick, I promise, personal story is I reflected back about how much I came to appreciate things that needed to be done not involving struggle or energy or deciding to do them. When I started college, I heard from the people sitting around me, these guys were grinching about an 8 o'clock class or a 9 o'clock class and talking about, you know, they'd rather keep on drinking the Jack Daniels that they did, like all the things that they would rather be doing than sitting there. And I was silently grateful for my experiences that I brought to that because I didn't waste one moment, one second of energy or ambivalence about doing it because I had already done something very analogous to that. Growing up on a farm, I fed the cattle every morning, every evening, 7 days a week. They had to eat. It was not something I debated. I never thought once, well, I guess I'll go feed those cattle this morning because some of them were mine. And it became something that I just did. You just did it because it was there. And that became the default mode, getting to class, not missing a class. That was the default mode. And I was grateful for the things that I really, you know, didn't even waste energy liking or not liking, but it, you know, I certainly went to school for 26 years to get away from chopping cotton. So as a mentor coach, now you're not a professional trainer or a dietitian. You're not giving directives, but you can make informed recommendations. I recommend Lodge's book to a number of people. And then you can listen to how your client takes information and makes choices to write their next chapter. And you're always free to challenge the choices or the trail of logic leading to them and to their fulfillment. Is it working or not? Now, one more thing. Two things above all others create neurogenesis, the making of new brain cells: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure. The hippocampus is the part of midbrain especially connected with two things, creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. And these findings have been replicated more recently in non-invasive studies in human populations in London taxicab drivers and University of Hamburg medical students. Another finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. So exercise and creative stimulation or engagement, which is exactly what we do with our clients in coaching, are two things that affect memory and creativity and the brain basis of these two functions. Now, The Power of Story has another chapter created by studies of athletes taking human growth hormone versus those taking a placebo. The group receiving the placebo believed they were actually getting human growth hormone, and they improved in four fitness tests, strength, endurance, power, sprint capacity, as much as the people who actually were taking growth hormone. And the Annals of Internal Medicine, endocrinologists at Stanford, reviewed 44 studies and concluded that belief had equally an important effect as the actual growth hormone. They concluded it's really the belief and the mind that improve performance. Now, here's to look at identity going into the future. Remember, the last step of the roadmap was P, program new identity, because to transform identity is what makes change permanent and makes it last. Princeton psychologist Emily Pronin found that in making financial decisions, especially how much money people save toward retirement, depends on how closely we identify our future selves, even how well we can see our future selves. She found that people who can more readily envision, can create a vision of themselves in the future, save 3 to 4 times as much money. Now, beginning at Stanford, brain imaging studies that would age progress in the area of what people save found the same thing. They save 3 to 4 times as much. There are also studies underway of age progression of showing people what it's like if they continue smoking versus if they don't in 10, 20, 30 years, how their features change. If they continue gaining a few pounds a week, if they exercise versus not, the age progression studies help people visualize when people show a lesser activity in thinking about their current and future self, they tend to save less money, work out less, not eat as healthily. The conclusion of these studies is that encouraging people to imagine themselves in the future can be very beneficial. Now, I want to conclude what we've been talking about, this section, but also what we've been talking about. Your story, let's talk about you now, not your client. Your story hides in plain sight. Think about the difference of people who lead a reactive life where circumstances and others determine their decisions and directions, who talk about what they're going to do, but who do the same thing week after week. By contrast, those who accomplish and believe have and create a different story. Their lives embody the story that they strategically create and bring alive for themselves and others. Their story, their plot, guides them, orients them to the script they consciously write, and they know they're in charge of their story. It's not there until they create it. Now, through these seminars, we've talked about how someone's story is hiding in plain sight. It's in the open, waiting to be seen, then transformed. In these seminars, we've been discussing how to help people write the next chapter of their life and business stories, of their wellness, of their career, of their money stories. These can be applied. Consider these questions. If your story to this point would be published as a book, what would the title and subtitle be? If your story builds to a major achievement in the near future, what would that be? Jot down your answer. There have been studies that show that when we put things in an output channel, it really makes a greater difference because it completes the brain circuitry. The USA Today did a study of New Year resolutions. Of people who made New Year resolutions, 4% completed them. of people who made a New Year's resolution and wrote them down, 44% completed them, over a four-fold difference. Describe a scenario in your story in which you, the protagonist, faced a major setback that brought out the best in you to successfully overcome it. What aspects of your story do you want to enhance? What do you want to leave out as you move ahead? What events or process has already foreshadowed your next success? Jot that down immediately. What roles will the most important people in your life play as you go forward? And finally, what's your spiritual essence? Now remember, you don't have to be religious in order to have spiritual meaning and significance and purpose. What is your essence? So let's look now in a kind of retrospective and looking ahead, but just kind of with a wider angle lens. Let's look at the life stages of success. Now, so this is going to move beyond the wide angle lens to, time-lapse photography. Success may mean different things at different points in adult life, at each developmental phase. I want to offer a quote because the quote says so succinctly an entire process. This is from Ruby D., I Dream a World, about how it may look in a relationship. It takes a long time to be really married. One marries many times at many levels in a marriage. If you have more marriages than divorces within the marriage, you're lucky and you stick it out. This is Goethe's way of looking at individual success. Whoever in middle age attempts to realize the wishes and hopes of his early youth invariably deceives himself. Each 10 years of a person's life has its own fortunes, its own hopes, its own desires. Dreams change. We realize some, relinquish some, create new ones. Growth is ideally flexible and dynamic. Once you achieve monetary success and professional prestige, you can figure out what's really important. Or, if you want to do it more quickly and more satisfyingly, figure it out first. And here's that time-lapse photo from a different perspective. This is from Emerson, one of my two favorite essayists. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. So, I'd like to do a final exercise with you to have you close your eyes and get in a very relaxed position. Take some deep breaths of relaxation in and breathe out any tensions. Another deep breath in for relaxation. Breathe out any tension. Imagine you're 90 years old. Look back at yourself now. Look at how things will turn out on your present trajectory. How would they turn out on a different path? Does the difference between the two suggest a change, a transition? What kind? Be specific. From 90 looking back, what do you see that you might have really seen right now but didn't acknowledge? What do you feel about your situation now? What do you want to tell yourself now? For example, any turns or cautions or risk that you should or should not have taken? keep your eyes closed and look very carefully at your 90-year-old eyes, your face, your hands, your 90-year-old body. Look around at where you are and at who's there with you. Remember, you always know more than you think. And one final question. As soon as you hear the question, write down the answer. That's the best way to get the authentic, fundamental answer that's not processed through your logical, conscious, intellectual brain. The first thing that comes to mind, write it down. What is your unlived life? We're in discussion mode now. I'm interested if you have thoughts, responses to anything that we talked about or any of the exercises. When I did the retreat with my buddy at various times for the CEOs and executives who were in a transition, the very first time I asked that question and asked them to write it down, just as I did for you, what is your unlived life? After a 2.5-day retreat, there were a number of people who approached me later and said that was the most impactful of any moment of any topic that we discussed, for me to look at what I didn't really realize was unlived. And it varied a number of things. It didn't light on anything in particular for a group like that of highly accomplished people, but it was something that was personally significant for each of them. But mostly it kind of launched an exploration. And that's, of course, what we want to do in coaching, is to begin something with a beginner's mind. It immediately moves someone from the default mode, because as you know about change, a body in motion tends to stay in motion, a body at rest tends to stay at rest. So the challenge is for someone to initiate just the change of looking in a different way, and then to create a strategic plan to act. Thoughts or questions or comments that any of you have about anything from the seminars, or what the process or content did for you, said to you, or resonated in any way?
Yeah, Dave?
Yes.
Yeah, are you still available after this to email with some thoughts or questions?
Absolutely.
Okay, what's the best place to reach you on that?
You can reach me through the website, MentorPath, or just directly, dkruger, D-K-R-U-E-G-E-R, at MentorPath.com. Absolutely. Anything you want to add or ask right now, just to kind of clear your throat and get started?
you talked about a whole lot around coaching, and just one of my challenges still is when, you know, talking to potential clients at the start and really trying to decipher if they're ready for coaching or not. You know, there's that some people really think they are, but then as you kind of get a little further, they're really not. And sometimes it's too late. They've signed up and they're in there with you, and you see they're not.
Yeah. Well, I think you're wanting them to be to speak more clearly than they think, because they have both. They have both in spades. They want to engage and want to change, but yet they want to keep doing the same thing. So that's exactly what we've been talking about for four seminars now, about how we collaboratively engage in a working alliance to help someone go step by step, also in a collaborative way, to navigate change that we can resonate with and understand their trepidation, their uncertainty, that their brain may be accustomed to reading the excitement and anxiety that's the same thing, more as anxiety, and then it makes sense not to proceed, so they don't think they're ready. Whatever someone says, they believe, but it likely is not the real reason. If someone says, well, I don't quite have the cash flow. I'm going to contact you later in the spring, or I'm going to contact you after I get to this point in my business because, I'll have more available cash now because they just can't. Now, they believe that, but they're responding to one or two things. One is the lack of confidence they read in the coach in making your professional recommendation, or they're opting out of going through the change and the uncertainty and the discomfort of doing change, even though they know they need to be, as two likely manifest reasons. There are probably others and more, but everybody doesn't want to change. They want other people to change. You know, you don't want anybody. You don't want to change. You want everybody else to change. Same with me. But this doesn't work that way. So that's understandable. That's where somebody began. So this is where you create that collaborative alliance with someone and first develop a working alliance so that you and they together are in the same place so you can go someplace new. That's what's unique about coaching. That's what you first do to develop that working alliance. Then you're going to be able to get away with saying whatever you need to say.
Yeah.
That's what's important, because you're going to need to say whatever you need to say. A mentor coach needs to be able to get away with saying anything, but to do it in a way that it's collaborative, that it's not off-putting, that it's helpful to look at the next step. But collectively, this is what we are doing together, and someone has never had that kind of relationship who understands what it's like to not want to do something and want to do it at the same time, to feel the anxiety and the uncertainty, but yet to reframe it as a signpost of progress, and then to look at a system of what's the next step and what's after what's next, and do it together throughout with the success of the client being paramount to both people, no matter what. So, don't ask the lack of ambivalence or being all in to be a prerequisite to begin. It won't ever happen. If a client is honest, it won't ever happen. Everybody begins with ambivalence.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Even the people who say they don't want to change really don't want to change. They want other people to change. But then they'll kind of exceed, maybe I'm the most likely person to do it if I got somebody to do it with and show me how and be a guide. You're being a guide. You're holding the flashlight. You're not telling them what they should find, but you're there with them shoulder to shoulder throughout. And they never forget that you're there. You're not telling them what, you're not ghostwriting it, but you are there. It's a collaborative effort.
Yeah. Well, thanks. That was helpful. Yeah, thank you.
And remember what we talked about what a client really wants from a coach that we talked about in this seminar. Because I believe those are all developmental aspects of a growth relationship, whether it's parent-child, whether it's coach-client, it's there. And those are the elements, the deconstructed elements of a collaborative relationship that has the growth of one as the preeminent focus. Well, thank you all very much. Let me know how this takes after it's marinated for a while and you apply it. I'm eager to hear. We'll be in touch sooner or later. I'm going to be doing another four-part teleseminars through CTA about wellness coaching in about a month. But anything that comes up, any clarification, let me know. I'll be eager to hear from you. Thanks very much for your attention, energy. Thanks for the positive comments and the emails. I appreciate it, and I look forward to future collaboration.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Bye.
Thanks, Dave.
Absolutely. See you now.
Bye-bye.